Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sea levels could rise an astounding 6 feet by 2100, according to a big new study, putting much of New York, London, Bangkok, and Shanghai underwater. This is double previous predictions and adds to the urgency of coming up with ways to slow global climate change. This hour on Point, alarming sea level rises and what the world needs to do now. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts via Skype is Rob DiCanto, professor in the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His new groundbreaking study on rising sea levels has got everybody talking, including us. You can link to the study on our website, onpointradio.org. Professor, nice to have you. Thank you.
Hi, Jane.
So the headline of your study caught huge headlines and a lot of attention. Tell us in your words what you found.
Well, we had been developing computer models for about a decade. This is with my colleague Dave Pollard at Penn State. And we had been trying to simulate some past warming events with very high sea levels. 125,000 years ago, geologists think that sea levels were about 6 to maybe 9 meters higher than today. And about 3 million years ago, when greenhouse gas levels we think were comparable to what they are like today, sea levels might have been as high as 20 meters, so maybe 50 or 60 feet higher than today. So that had been a big challenge for us. And for more than a decade, we had tried to simulate these past high sea levels. And it really wasn't until the last, about a year and a half, we included some new physics in these models. And when we did, we were able to simulate these past very high sea levels. And that gave us a little bit of confidence to apply these models to see what might happen in the future. And even surprising to us was the magnitude and the rate of sea level rise that the models are suggesting could happen in the future.
Right. Up to 6 feet. Sea levels could rise up to 6 feet in the next 80 to 100 years, right?
That's right. Yep. At the sort of worst case scenario, following a business-as-usual sort of greenhouse gas emission scenario, we're seeing about 1 meter of sea level rise, and that's just from Antarctica, so not the sea level that would come from the potential retreat of parts of the Greenland ice sheet or from the oceans continuing to get warmer or from little small alpine ice caps and mountain glaciers, just the Antarctic component, about a meter.
So researchers had long assumed that the worst effects of this could take hundreds, if not thousands of years. But what you're saying here and what you found in your computer modeling is that this crisis could happen within the lifetime of children being born today.
That's right. And even in our modeling work over the last decade or so, you know, we were looking at sort of century to even millennial, thousand-year timescale retreat of the ice sheet. And with these new processes included, where really for the first time we've been able to simulate these past events, and that's really the key here, and that's sort of, you know, how we test the models and we even tune the physics in the models based on their performance on these past mm-hmm. events, we're seeing these really accelerated rates.
Can you give us a sense of what a 6 foot rise in sea levels would mean? What does that look like?
Oh, that starts to literally remap the coastlines of the world. If you were looking down on the Earth from a satellite or an orbiting spaceship, it would look like a little bit different planet from where shorelines would be. Something that isn't appreciated by everyone, and this is often a surprise to people, sea level doesn't change the same everywhere around the world by the same amount. So different parts of the world will feel a retreat of the Antarctic ice sheet differently. So some places will actually would potentially feel more than that 1 meter of sea level rise, and other places less.
Places like New York and Boston, is that right?
That's right. So the Northern Hemisphere, in a sense, has more to fear from a 1 meter worth of sea level rise if it comes from Antarctica rather than the closer by Greenland ice sheet. So we here in the Northern Hemisphere do have a lot to fear from Antarctica's retreat.
So you laid out a scenario where in the next 100 years we have this up to 6 foot rise in sea levels, but you also lay out a scenario that looks toward the year 2500, and the numbers in that case are astounding.
They are. They're more than 10 meters.
10 meters.
10 meters. And what's really...
Which is about what, about 50 feet?
Yeah, about 30 feet or more.
Okay.
Yep, I think at the highest end we're looking at 15 meters in some of the simulations in the year 2500. And that, it sounds like almost science fiction way out into the future. But when I think about the design lifespan of a modern skyscraper, for example, in a coastal city, you know, I mean, just even thinking about New York City and its 400 year history, and the Empire State Building is going to be seeing a 100 year anniversary before too long. So, you know, these are rapid rates, and, you know, certainly geologically, but I think even you could make the argument on a human time scale.
Let me bring another voice in here from New York, Ben Strauss, Vice President for Sea Level and Climate Impacts at Climate Central, a nonprofit news organization. Ben, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
So what do you make of this data? What do you make of this scenario?
Well, for a long time, the climate science community has been converging on a projection of around 3 feet, up to 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century. So to suggest that a very plausible amount of sea level rise by the end of the century could be 6 feet really is earth-shaking. Now, I think at this stage, this is the first study of this kind. We all hope that it won't be borne out. But it's a major advance, and I've been making sea level maps for around 5 years, looking at these maps around the United States and around the world. And the difference between 2 or 3 feet versus 5 or 6 feet mm-hmm. can't be understated.
In what way? How do you see that? What do you mean?
Well, let's put it this way. 2 or 3 feet, most places in the United States experience floods that are 2 or 3 feet above today's high tide line. They, in fact, only 20% of more than 100 different gauges, tide gauges, that NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they have long-term records, 50 years, 100 years. They track the water level. And around 80% of gauges have had at least once some event that was more than 3 feet high.
Uh-huh.
But fewer than 20% have ever seen water higher than 6 feet.
So these are floods like until we've never seen, right? Sea levels,
Well, this would, 6 feet of sea level rise would mean that most places, you know, your average day with an average high tide would be water higher than that place than we've ever observed in that place.
Let me play some sound here. This is from the news website Vice, airing a segment in January on HBO. Here's Vice speaking to Eric Rinho of University of California, Irvine, professor of Earth System Science. He's on the southern tip of Patagonia at the Martinelli Glacier, beyond which is the Antarctic Peninsula. And while they're speaking here, part of the glacier actually comes off.
This glacier is retreating extremely fast, and this is not part of the natural cycle. In the last 10, 20 years, they retreated more than the past century and even more. It's like changing the limit on the freeway from 55 miles an hour to 550 miles an hour.
Okay.
That sound is the glacier actually falling into the water. Rob DeCanto, tell me about this West Antarctic ice sheet, because much of your research revolved around this, right? The remnant of the last ice age, larger than Mexico. This is the sheet that actually, if melted, would cause so many problems.
Well, that's right. So we break the Antarctic ice sheet into two parts, the West Antarctic and the East. And the West Antarctic ice sheet is special, and it's different from the ice sheet that's on Greenland or on East Antarctica because it's sitting on bedrock. So the land that the ice is sitting on is actually well below sea level, in many places more than 1,000 meters or a kilometer below sea level. So it is essentially an ice sheet that is bathed in ocean water. And so it's sensitive to changes in ocean temperature. And we have been seeing retreat of parts of that West Antarctic ice sheet. We've been observing places where the ice sheet is in contact with the ocean retreating. And those places happen to be where the ocean has been warming in recent years. So there's certainly a strong connection between warm water and ice melt. And, you know, we all sort of have that practical experience that an ice cube in a warm glass of water doesn't last very long. So the community had been really focused, and my group too, and Dave Pollard and I, on trying to understand those interactions between warm water, what that does to ice. But it was really sort of the recognition that in the not too distant future, we're going to start to see a spread of temperatures above freezing in the summertime around Antarctica. And when we started to account for those physics, so warm temperatures, not just under the ice sheet in the ocean water, but the air above, making some melt water, so liquid water on the surface of the fringes of the ice sheet. And then we thought about what happens when you have liquid water getting into crevasses and breaking ice shelves open.
That is the incredible new research and the incredible reality that we're looking at this hour. Sea levels rising up to 6 feet by 2100. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about groundbreaking new study this hour showing sea levels could rise up to 6 feet in less than 100 years. We're speaking this hour with Rob DeCanto, professor in the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts. He is the co-author of this new study looking at rising sea levels. And also Ben Strauss, vice president for sea level and climate impacts at Climate Central, a nonprofit news organization. Here's some sound from CBS Miami's Gary Nelson reporting on high tides that caused major flooding back in September on Miami Beach.
For a third straight day, much of Miami Beach was awash in flood waters, born of a king tide, the result of an extraordinary alignment of the Earth and the Moon that saw residents and tourists taking to bicycles, cars stranded in water above the running boards.
Cards stranded in water above the running boards. Ben Strauss, are there cities, there it is, Miami down there, are there cities that could, with a lot of planning, avoid disaster with the computer models that we're looking at now?
Well, a brief point about Miami and the kind of flooding in that sound. We did a study just a month ago that found that 3 out of 4 coastal floods in the United States over the last decade are already being tipped over the balance by human-caused sea level rise. And that's just a few inches that we've seen over the last century plus. Mm. Now, cities are working on the problem. Miami Beach is investing close to $1 billion on elevating some of their roads and putting in pumps. And it is improving the situation, but it's a much greater challenge to imagine how you deal with 5 feet instead of 5 inches.
So $1 billion in Miami Beach. Are other cities acting with similar urgency?
I don't know the investment totals in some other places, but I know Boston is taking it seriously. New York is, Norfolk and Hampton Roads, the Bay Area, and those are all highly vulnerable places. I think there is an opportunity here, paradoxically, that the places that are able to innovate and find a way to live with rising water will have a model that they can export to the world, because this is a problem that is going to be happening everywhere at the same time.
A lot of callers on this. Let's get first to Keith in Milton, Delaware. Hi, Keith. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to put give you guys a concrete example of what the impact of something like this 6-foot level will have. I live in southern Delaware. This state is primarily a coastal state. The entire eastern side of the state is Delaware River and Bay, and also we have the Atlantic Ocean. So in southern Delaware, our sea level, our ground level is only about 6 to 13 feet above sea level. If we have a 6-foot rise in the ocean level, it's going to essentially flood a huge swath of the state. I think the largest newspaper in the state over the years has done a number of examples of articles on this flooding. It will wipe out about a third, as much as a third of the state. I mean, it would look like what southern Louisiana looked like before Katrina and after Katrina. Mm. And even on a daily basis, when we have, I've lived in the state for 20 years, and when I first moved here, I never, ever remember hearing coastal flood warnings on a weekly basis and a monthly basis sometimes, with just a change of the tide because of a full moon or something. Mm.
Keith, thank you for the call. Rob DeCanto, is it possible to prepare? I mean, should we all be moving away from coastlines as far as possible?
Well, it depends on which greenhouse gas future that we end up going down. It's not just about the absolute numbers either. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the rates of sea level rise. So today we measure the rate of sea level rise in millimeters per year. I think the global average is a little over 3 millimeters per year right now. And that doesn't sound like a lot. Of course, it adds up over a decade or two. But in the worst case scenarios, at least in this study, you know, it implies the potential for rates of sea level rise once you get out to the end of this century, you know, on the order of 3-4 centimeters per year, not millimeters per year. So literally an order of magnitude faster rate. And that I can only imagine will be really challenging from a geoengineering aspect in terms of infrastructure and hardening our coastlines, protection. And at that point, I'd think that we'd really be having to face the reality of retreat in a lot of places, not just protection.
That equates to more than a foot per decade.
1 foot per decade. Well, we talk about rising seawater and so many millions of people affected. What about the sea itself? What about the delicate pH balance in the seawater? How does that affect sea life, Rob DeCanto?
Well, I'm not much of a chemist or a geochemist, but we don't know what the impact of that much fresh water going into the Southern Ocean will have globally. It will have some effect on the ocean and potentially the global ocean circulation, and that's important because the ocean is important for moving heat around the planet. The Southern Ocean is also the most productive ocean in the world. It's where, you know, the base of the ocean food chain is sort of founded. And that part of the ocean is important for actually absorbing a lot of the fossil fuel-derived carbon that's going into the atmosphere. So a big disruption in ocean circulation is something that we'd have to think about and worry about, too. And that's an active area of research right now.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Princeton, New Jersey. Robert Sokolow, a co-director of the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at the Princeton Environmental Institute at Princeton University, where he's also a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering. Rob Sokolow, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Jane.
So this research is much more alarming than what we've considered before. Your initial response?
Well, first of all, I'm very glad you're having this program. I think we are not focusing enough on the worst outcomes that are consistent with climate science. I think we've made a mistake in emphasizing how settled the science is, because somehow that would make people more willing to act. But I've thought for some time that it's really important for people to understand how uncertain the science is in terms of bad news and good news. This is a piece of very bad news, that Antarctica could be as unstable as this paper suggests. And we have to take it on board. We don't know for sure, but I've always felt that one of the strongest motivations for acting on climate change is to buy insurance against some of these awful outcomes. I think also we have got to make all of this more vivid. There are very particular ice shelves mentioned in this paper. I don't know what they look like. I'd like to know them. I'd like them to be a sort of a rogues gallery that we all have in mind. We know the names. We simply haven't been sufficiently vigilant. And I think this is a role for the media and the arts community and so forth. Let's get to know these places. They have our destiny is wrapped up in them.
Let me play some sound here. This is United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking at a press conference in December at the Paris Climate Change Conference.
The global thermostat is rising. This year has been the warmest in recorded history. There is no time to lose. Science tells us the window could soon close on our ability to prevent severe and irreversible climate impact.
And here's President Obama in December. This was after the Paris Accord, addressing the nation about the deal struck in Paris at the climate talks.
The problem's not solved because of this accord. But make no mistake, the Paris Agreement establishes the enduring framework the world needs to solve the climate crisis. It creates the mechanism, the architecture, for us to continually tackle this problem in an effective way.
Rob Sokolow, we made serious commitments in the Paris climate change talks. If we were to follow through on everything we committed to there, is that enough? Is that enough?
It's an enormous amount. I think we can be overly pessimistic about, of course, we have more to do. But if we get into the groove, if we start committing really to change our power plants, we have, for example, if we build better cities, if we have a really different automobile, this will make a tremendous difference. In part because the U.S. is a leader. If we fall back, if we undo some of the commitments we have put in place that we are promising to accomplish, it will not only affect climate change because of our loss of will, but because others will be disheartened as well. I think Obama has it exactly right. I mean, this is a framework that was settled. For the very first time, the whole world agrees to take this problem seriously and to make commitments side by side, looking at each other, building confidence that each one is going to stay the course, as opposed to the previous situation where only the developed world was doing things and the developing world was allowed to be on the sidelines. That's a tremendous accomplishment. Hmm. The other thing I want to say is Ban Ki-moon mentions this very year is the hottest, and that's important. But we have implicit in these sea level studies an extension of empathy. Do we care what happens in 2100? You mentioned that our grandchildren or children, depending on our ages, will be alive in 2100. So that seems to be something we care about. You talk to businessmen about 2100 and their eyes roll. That is just way beyond their time horizons. Mm. Can we develop a sense as a species that our collective future matters, that what we do to people in 2100 is our own obligation? That hasn't really happened. This may really work because sea level is the premier example of an impact which plays out in a kind of relentless fashion. It's not an acute event in 2100. It's the relentless buildup of the sea level.
An extension of empathy. I like that phrase. Let me get some callers in here. Christian is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Christian, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
Question for your distinguished panel. I live in Kentucky. We just moved here from Louisville, which is a major river city. Former Mayor Bloomberg of New York City said that Louisville was number one on his list for climate change risk, not just from pollution, but just from sea level rise. And I'm wondering if your panel could talk about, is it just coastal communities that would be affected by a 6-foot sea level rise, or also major river communities along the Ohio River and Mississippi?
Got it. Great question, Christian. What about riverside communities? Let's see. Rob DeCanto, would you take that?
Well, Ben might be a better person to answer this, but I would think that, you know, the base sea level will impact rivers. It'll impact parts of river systems that trap or don't trap sediment. If it gets as bad as sort of this worst case scenario suggests it could get, I would think that far upstream rivering systems will be impacted all over the world.
Ben Strauss, do you agree?
Well, I think Louisville is safe, and I would the direct effect will be close to river mouths. Still a great number of people, but it's important to add that more than 90% of world commerce comes through ports, which are usually in the lowest lying place along our coasts, and that as people become displaced, as some surely will, they will be migrating throughout the country. So even if you live far from the shore, sea level rise is going to be an important problem.
Let's get Mark in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Mark. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes,
I have two questions, one about the model and one about the later effects. Does the model predict accelerating rates of melting, or is it steady throughout the century? I mean, could we in 2060, could we see 3 feet of sea level rise? And again, at the end, when we have 6 feet, you'd spoken earlier about the NOAA sensors seeing storm mm-hmm. surges of 3 feet or higher. Would we see that on top of that 6 feet, so 9 feet or higher of sea level?
Mark, I'm glad you called. Robert DeCanto, would you take that? Accelerating effects of melting, will we see that?
Yeah, well, we would see in these worst case scenarios an acceleration in sea level rise. So in the beginning of the second half of the 21st century, so 2060, 2070, and that acceleration would increase until probably early in the 21st century. And then what happens is eventually all the very vulnerable ice will have been lost. And then it's the less vulnerable ice that will still be contributing to sea level rise, but the rate will begin to subside. So there'll still be ongoing sea level rise for centuries and potentially even millennia, but the rate would begin to probably drop. I think in these simulations, maybe around the year 2200 or so. Mm. But again, we'd be talking about centimeters per year sorts of rates.
Mark, thank you. Let's get Mike in here from Chicago, Illinois. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I wanted your guests to comment on the coastal Great Lakes. I live in Chicago, mm-hmm. and would the sea level in the Atlantic and Pacific, et cetera, affect through the canals that feed mm-hmm. the Great Lakes? Mm-hmm. Would the coastal cities on the Great Lakes be affected?
Thank you, Mike. That northern region, Ben Strauss, what do you say?
In our analysis, the Great Lakes do not have anything to fear from sea level rise directly. I could point your listeners to surgingseas.org, where you can type in any zip code in the country and take a look at what land is below 3 feet or 6 feet or 10 feet. Choose your level, because as the last caller noted, the sea level is really the launch pad for storm surge. So any level we project in the future is just where the next storm starts. So we can't just think of 3 feet of sea level rise or 6 feet of sea level rise. Rather, what does a storm look like on top of that?
And Rob DeCanto, this is not just sea level rise we're talking about. It's also monster storms, stronger than anything we've seen in modern times. Is that right?
Well, yes. That was the focus of Jim Hansen's recent paper that came out a week or two before this one, pointing out that changes, again, probably translated through the ocean, the impact of this freshwater melt, in addition to warming temperatures having an impact on storms, the storm track, places where it snows. It could even be, long-term impacts on things like where droughts happen or don't happen, thinking about multiple centuries down the road.
Huge reset in the planet. Rob DeCanto, Ben Strauss, Robert Sokolow, stick with us. We're discussing new research that says sea levels could rise by 6 feet in just the next 80 to 100 years. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about new research that shows sea levels could rise up to 6 feet by 2100. I want to play some sound from the campaign trail. This, of course, has come up in the presidential campaign this season. Here's Senator Ted Cruz saying that the climate change debate is too political.
One of the problems in the global warming debate is far too much of the debate is driven by politics and political agendas rather than by the actual science.
And here's Senator Bernie Sanders pledging to combat climate change last week at a campaign rally in South Bronx. He said there is a moral obligation to protect the planet.
Together, we must have and accept the moral responsibility of leaving this planet in a way that is healthy and habitable to our children and our grandchildren.
Professor Sokolow, what do you hear on the campaign trail from the candidates and others about what's happening with sea level rise?
Well, I wish these were the only quotes. I think I agree with both of them. Ted Cruz is right that it's too political, and Sanders is right that it's a moral issue. We should not have made this a political issue at all. I mean, it's really unfortunate. The problem is universal. The people who red and blue are just as concerned about their grandchildren's environment as so this is really a very unfortunate turn, which has really only happened in the United States. I wish I could figure out a way to undo it. The part of it has been that there are consequences to dealing with reducing the carbon emissions of the planet. Coal has more emissions per unit of electricity produced than natural gas, so the oil and gas industry will prosper relative to the coal industry unless we invoke certain ideas which are ready to try, which involve capturing the carbon dioxide from the coal power plants and putting it underground. It raises the cost of power. So much of this is about willingness to pay something extra, not expect to have a free ride. This is a serious problem that we need to pay our way out of, just as we paid a little bit more for products to reduce air pollution or to have worker safety involved. And that comes around. That's why a paper like this may actually be a useful push. Mm. If we think we're not getting anything out of it, we are very unwilling to pay for any of these changes.
So let me ask you about that new technology that's out there, Professor Sokolow. I mean, can we innovate our way out of disaster is the headline question. I mean, you have so many solutions like, you know, creating solar panels, which make economic sense. But when you talk about some of the more costly ideas, like actually sucking carbon out of the atmosphere, I mean, is that a reasonable solution? Is that a reasonable idea to look toward?
Well, everything is going to require some effort and some dislocation. Solar on roofs, we don't dismiss that as just a winner because it does cost additional money at this time. It's being subsidized. It will have impacts on land as we put it on fields. The first list of things to do: make more efficient cars, have better designed buildings. Those are absolutely critical, and they come first. And the developing world, we're not paying attention to the cities being built in the developing world. They are, for the most part, imitating the cities that we have. They're not very well designed. The buildings and appliances are not very efficient. And we're looking the other way. They, in turn, are looking at us and seeing whether we really will develop a far more efficient car that we drive. And so I think we're a long way from needing to – in terms of maybe a couple of decades of serious work toward commitments that we fully understand right now. As far as pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, we can do it. There are some clever ways people are proposing that are even new. It generally will cost more to take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere than to take it out of the flue gases of coal power plants and natural gas power plants, so that those are usually the things we would do first. Meanwhile, we can get better at ways of pulling carbon dioxide. But that happens slowly, pulling mm-hmm. carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Is at most going to counteract a certain minor fraction of our emissions at the present day.
Well, honestly, some of these solutions sound a little crazy. I mean, there's one option out there to put water back into Antarctica to rebuild the glaciers. I mean, that's serious. People are talking about this quite serious idea, are they not?
They are, and they should be, because it's an intriguing idea. The center of Antarctica is quite high, and you make it a little higher by putting ice from building up snow. People have talked about modifying the weather pattern so it snows, and they've talked about some kind of a railroad that takes seawater from the edge of the continent and puts it in the middle, way uphill. A lot of energy, estimated to be maybe more energy than we're using right now.
Right, like 7% of the global energy supply, right?
That was 7%, I just checked on that, was for an emission rate that we now – to counter the rise that was before this paper. It would take more like 50% to deal with what we're talking about in this paper. So, that's an enormous enterprise, but maybe that's not the cleverest way to do it. Maybe there are ways of making nature work for you. We have to think of the planet as our responsibility, and then we have to ask how much we want to deliberately modify it rather than adapting to some of the changes that are coming. This is a spiritual argument as well as a technical one. Mm. We don't want to tame the planet entirely, I think, and make it a zoo and make it completely engineered, but that's a conversation that's a political conversation. We mustn't be scared of these questions, and I think that the paper we're talking about is encouraging or really confronting the issues around the geoengineering.
Listener Stephen on Facebook says you'd have to convince the 2 billion or so people living in China or India that they don't want electricity or cars like we have in the United States. Angie says, don't like it one bit, but I'm not frightened. I live in Missouri. I've planted more shrubs. I've used the same cup all year for refills. I use less water. I buy used clothing, doing what little I can to help. Rob DeCanto, it's going to take more than changing out our light bulbs and setting up recycling bins to change the course here, would you say?
Well, and for your listeners who haven't seen the complete study, we've been talking about the worst case scenarios, these really outrageous high sea levels. But the good news is that in the simulations where we follow an aggressive reduction in emissions starting soon, it would have to begin soon, there's very little contribution to sea level rise from Antarctica. So we dramatically reduce our risk to these really very high sea levels with an aggressive mitigation policy. And so it would have to be at the scale that is internationally coordinated, I would think, and political, through the international political channels. In addition to all of our individual, motivation to do the small things every day.
Ben Strauss, international coordination and international cost. I mean, who pays the bill for a lot of these solutions?
Well, that's a great question. Your caller asked about China and India, and it is interesting to note that China is by far the world leader in investment in clean energy, and it is the most vulnerable nation to sea level rise. It has the largest number of people in places that are threatened. 5 out of 6 people in the world who live in the lowest places live in Asia. So while we have huge challenges here in the United States, there's even more motivation to do something about this in Asia.
Let's get more calls in here. Brian in Montreal, Canada. Hi, Brian. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. I'm calling from the country with the longest ocean coastline in the whole world, so we're really touched by this, and we're right next door. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask the person in Amherst, your professor who's done this modeling, how he brackets the chances of all these different options he's talking about. I'm a practicing engineer in retirement. We always try to make a guess of, okay, how likely is this? How likely is that? And at what point is the people paying for our project ready to handle the risk? Do you have any way of analyzing the probabilities of things? And in specific terms, up in our Arctic, we're already noticing that warming water is releasing hot methane that's been trapped underneath the seafloor in cages of water for millennia. Have you even looked at that as a risk factor, or are you leaving that to atmospheric scientists? Because if we start releasing methane from underwater as the ocean water is warm, we've got real runaway warming.
Brian, thank you. A couple of big questions there. Rob DeCanto, give us your best short answers, if you would.
So, you know, in this study, we are looking at different scenarios as outlined, for example, by the IPCC. So sort of standard future greenhouse gas scenarios. The permafrost methane, you know, issue, potential positive feedback on top of the emission scenarios that we're looking at, I imagine is a real possibility, but not considered here. So we run ensembles, many simulations, looking at these different scenarios of future greenhouse gas emissions. And the ensembles all use slightly different physics in these models, and that gives us a feeling for the uncertainty in the system, which then at the end of the day lets us say something about probabilities. So, for example, even though we say there's very much reduced risk of very high sea level contribution from Antarctica in the future if we follow a dramatic reduction in emissions, we still find that there's about a 10% probability that there could be substantial retreat of the West Antarctic ice sheet, but a 90% probability that there would be very little to no retreat of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So absolutely excellent question, and we are trying to dig a little bit deeper into the probability game.
Brian, thank you so much for the call. I'm Jane Clayson. Rob Sokola, let me bring you back in here. I mean, we talk about these worst-case scenarios, best-case scenarios as well, but we're talking about cities like New York and London and Shanghai, where coastlines are dramatically changing. Talk about the human disruption in these cases.
Well, the human disruption, if we have to relocate our cities inland across the world, it's just enormous. Most of us have thought that was something that would be happening in the 22nd, 23rd century. This is moving it closer, and it's clear from this conversation and from others that moving it closer is going to be politically very salient, and that's important. I do want to add something about the 2 billion very poor, if I can go back to that. It really is a mistake to focus on the eradication of poverty as somehow in conflict with dealing with climate change. The very poorest people who have living on a very primitive economy can become lower middle class, have a roof over their heads and some light bulbs and a refrigerator and some local engines. And that doesn't cost – if you multiply that by 2 billion people, and there's plenty of room to accommodate that with climate change. It's middle class consumption. It's people who live like us and like our poorer people in this country. That's the lifestyle that people are aspiring to, and that's the lifestyle people are aspiring to in the developing world. It's that transition into the middle class, into a life with appliances and exuberant activity. That's what's challenging us. We should not confuse this with poverty alleviation. We can do that, and we should do that, and we will not have almost any – we'll have only a minor amount of additional work to do to deal with climate change.
Sherry in Pella, Iowa. Sherry, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
And I appreciate so much this conversation among your panel. My question today is, as important as it is to analyze this latest research and to discuss what's going to happen in the coming decades and the cities that you've mentioned, I want viewers to understand that in some parts of the world, the time has passed for amelioration. And from that humanitarian perspective, one of your guests made the point that it's a moral and even spiritual matter for us. Island nations like Kiribati have contributed almost nothing to the greenhouse conditions, yet they are already today reaping the very worst impact of climate change. They're losing land and lives every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your guests think we need to be working on in that respect.
Thank you so much, Sherry. Professor Sokolow, would you respond?
Well, side by side, we have mitigation and adaptation. They are both important. Mitigation is moving away from carbon emissions in many ways that are available, above all through a more efficient energy system, by expansion of renewable energy. Adaptation is indeed in some places zoning, which accepts that certain parts of the landscape are not going to be inhabited by buildings. Canals and various civil engineering works. There's a very interesting project to put artificial islands in New York Bay, New York Harbor, and then that will reduce the strength of the storm surges because they absorb a lot of the energy. That's work by by a colleague of mine, Guy Nordenson, and his colleagues. That's an example of how we're going to be able to do various things to make this impacts less severe. When we plan new harbors around the world, we are taking into account sea level rise. We're going to adjust some of those calculations, I think. But the world is making enormous investments, which depend on an estimate of how much sea level they'll see by the end of the century.
Professor Sokolo, thank you. Rob DeCanto, jump in here again. There are some people and some scientists who dismiss your research. What do you say to them at this point?
Well, we certainly acknowledge and even make a very strong statement in this paper that these really aren't hard and fast predictions per se. There's still a great deal of uncertainty, but this is the first time that we have had a model that we've been developing for a long time, where the model is been successfully simulating past sea level rise. So when we do something to the model, if it does something crazy relative to things that have happened in the past, we discount those physics. So, you know, here's a demonstrated tool that has been able to, for the first time, simulate past changes in the ice sheet, past sea level rise events successfully. And it was even a surprise to us as to, what it shows when we apply the model to the future. We are still working on improving the models, trying to include more and better physics, test them against conditions in the past. It's all still very much a work in progress, but this shows that there is a greater potential for very high sea level than we had seen in the past.
More to come. Robert DeCanto, professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thank you so much, Rob, for your time today.
Thank you.
Ben Strauss at Climate Central. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
And Robert Sokolo, co-director of the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.